Good evening, everyone, and welcome to tonight's discussion, The Dome as Artist Muse. My name is Robert Heather, and I'm the manager of collection interpretation here at the State Library. Our event is being held on the traditional country of the Kulin Nation, and I wish to acknowledge them as traditional owners. I would also like to pay my respects to the elders and the elders of other communities who may be here tonight. Tonight's event is the first in a series of conversations centred around the library's iconic domed reading room in honour of the centenary of the Dome. This series of conversations celebrate the Dome as a source of inspiration for writers, artists, musicians and photographers. In my role, I'm responsible for the exhibitions, the events, the fellowships and the publishing here at the library. And it's really exciting how the library interacts with creative people of all types. I'm delighted tonight to welcome arts journalist Ray Gill, artist Julia Ciccioni, Ross Coulter and Marco Lucio, and the Enchanted Dome exhibition curator Anne Carew to reflect on the library's dome reading room as an imaginative haven and a source of creative inspiration. We have a very good creative fellowship program here at the library which creates opportunities for artists and other creative people to interact with our collections, and some of these projects that people will be talking about tonight have actually come from one of those. Following on from the discussion, we'd like to invite you to stay and enjoy two short films, Ross Coulter's 10,000 Paper Planes and Casimir Burgess and Julia Ciccioni's 67. Tonight's discussion will be chaired by Ray Gill, who will be leading it. Ray is an arts journalist well known for his incisive writing on the national and international arts scene. He graduated in law and arts from Melbourne University in 1986. He has worked at the Sun News Pictorial, the Sunday Age, The Age, where he was the newspaper's arts editor for over a decade, until he and along with 70 other journalists left last September. He wrote a column called Culture Vulture for The Age for 6 years, which has been described as having a knack for cutting through the bullshit to reveal the little white bone of reality that is there once the bone and gristle is removed. He is now writing a comic novel for Hardy Grant Books. Tonight, Ray will be joined by special guests Julia Ciccioni, Ross Coulter, Marco Lucio and Anne Carew. We have a really outstanding panel tonight, so over to you, Ray.
Thank you, everyone, for coming. This year, of course, we're celebrating the centenary of the Dome, designed by Norman Peebles. And as part of the year-long celebrations, the Enchanted Dome exhibition has been put together by Anne Carew. And maybe you've been to see it already, maybe you came before this talk, but you can also go and see it straight after, which, if you haven't seen it, I encourage you to do, because it's open, I think, till 9 p.m, isn't it? Anne will soon talk about how she put the show together. It's the work of 34 artists. We also have, as has been said, three of the artists whose work has been inspired by the State Library or the Dome with us as well. You've already been introduced. Do I need to give your names again? Everyone knows who they are, Julia, Ross and Marco. But before Anne speaks, I just thought we'd just reflect a little on the reading room, which I suppose in its most basic way, a reading room or a library is a place of functionality. It's a public utility. It's a storage centre here for 2 million books. It has spiral staircases where once upon a time you'd hear the stilettos of the librarians going up and down, and that was probably the only sound that you're allowed to make. It's a place for catalogue cards, photocopiers, faxes, computer systems and portals. It's a place so practical that it required a panopticon in its centre where an invigilator, is that the correct term? Basically a prison guard, more or less, stood in the centre making sure everyone in every corner of the room did what they were supposed to do and not damage anything or get too excited by what they were reading, I suppose. But as this exhibition so deftly shows, this particular library that Melbourne is lucky to have is also a place of inspiration. Its dome acts as a sort of secular temple. It inspires those who use it, those who just come to look at it, or those who glance at it from the street. And for Melburnians, I think it's very important because we always hear people saying, oh, well, let's have a landmark competition. We need a landmark. Let's build a 112-storey building. And we actually have one that's been here for 100 years at the very centre of the city. The knowledge stored here has inspired countless works of literature, art, science and learning. But it's also been a place for assignations, a place for meetings, a place for dates, a place where people meet and eventually get married and have children. Well, not in the library, of course. But it's great to see 34 artists in the show and how they interpret that room and this building in a very particular way. But I don't think it's celebrated enough in popular culture. And, you know, I've got a thing for popular culture, and I think it's been pretty scant how little has been done. Though, if you were here a month ago for the White Nights Festival, it was incredible inside because it was turned into this kaleidoscope of colour and movement and sound. It was a new way of seeing it after 100 years using modern technology. It was brilliant. It was also, apparently, I'm told, the exterior was seen in On the Beach. I think you told me that, Anne?
Someone told you that. On the Beach was filmed on the forecourt of the State Library.
On the forecourt, the 1950s film. And last year it was also included in a film called Any Questions for Ben, and the reading room was also used in that. As you will see, if you go upstairs to the exhibition, a Sydney band called Faker made a video here. The song was called Hurricane, though I tried to follow the connection between Hurricane and the state, the reading room, and I didn't get it. And in 1994, Ben Lewin, the filmmaker, made a film called Lucky Break, in which the reading room played a pivotal role. The film was starred Gia Carides and her husband, Anthony LaPaglia. And Carides played a writer of a 50 Shades of Grey sort of erotic novels. And she's partly crippled from polio, like Ben Lewin himself. And if you've seen his latest film, The Sessions, it covers a similar territory. And for some reason, while she's in the state, the reading room, she has to read out the erotica that she's written. I don't know, she just reads it to herself. And he overhears it, becomes attracted to her, doesn't realise that she's got polio, and then a jewel heist follows, you know, which is just a natural progression, of course. Anyway, for some reason, there are no stills from Lucky Break in this exhibition, which I think is a poor show, Anne. Having said that, I will now let Anne say what she chose and how she chose the works for the exhibition. Anne.
Great. Thanks, Ray. And just getting back to Faker, I mean, it's interesting, Nathan, who's the lead singer for the song Hurricane, he himself is someone who has a great love of books. And so looking for a location, the band's based in Sydney, that's why he turned to the Dome Reading Room. And I guess that's an interesting thread through a lot of the works in the show, that people have come here because of the book collections and then perhaps the architecture's taken over. But I thought I was going to give you a few facts, and I think I still will give a few facts.
Oh, actually, I forgot to introduce Anne properly. I'm very sorry about that. Anne is an art historian and a curator. She's worked at the Ian Potter Gallery, she's worked at the Geelong Gallery, and she's been at the State Library since 2007, and in that period has worked on many exhibitions, including another one that is on at the moment, Gusto, the Culinary History of Victoria. Sorry.
Thank you, Ray. Look, I thought I'd just give you a few facts before we started. The library opened in 1856 and the Dome opened in 1913. And in 2003, it was refurbished. It was built over a four-year period from a bit longer than that, actually. I've got my dates wrong here. From 1907 to 1913. And as it rose on the Melbourne skyline, it was a very dominating building and the cause of great interest in Melbourne. The architect was Norman Peebles, and his firm was founded by Joseph Reed, who was the original architect on this site. It was very briefly the largest concrete dome in the world, measuring 114 feet or 34.75 metres in diameter and height. And when it opened, it was heralded as one of the greatest buildings on earth. It was a dominating presence in the Melbourne skyline. It's the only building on this site that has remained in continuous use as a library. And in 1913, the book collections of the library and the library staff occupied the Dome Reading Room. It was modelled on the Library of Congress in Washington, and also the dome reading room of the British Library. The other thing that one of my colleagues pointed out today too, there is a tradition of domed rooms for libraries. The Radcliffe Camera in Oxford, which was built in 1748, is a beautiful dome space. And then we had in Melbourne the Parliamentary Library in 1860, which if you've had the chance to go up and have a look at that, that's another just exquisite space that takes you back to another world. And the Supreme Court Library, which was built in 1884. And often these libraries encapsulate the idea of the earth and the sky. So you've got the grounding of the earth, the book collections, and then the heavens above. There were 300 volumes on open access when the library first opened and 30,000 stored around the building. When they took all the books out in the lead up to 2003, in 1998, they took all the books out and there were 2.4 million items. So the main intention of the exhibition was to celebrate the centenary of this great space. And when I began to look around for content, we weren't entirely sure whether we could do a whole exhibition about the Dome Reading Room, but I quickly discovered that there was a vast archive of photographs, visual material and other records concerning the Dome. So I quickly placed a limitation on myself that it would need to be works that had some evidence of creative inspiration. And the things that I was looking at were responses to the building, the collections, the ambience of the room and the behaviour of visitors and staff. At the time, I was also reading articles that had been published on the Dome and looking in literary sources. And I suppose what struck me was that quite serious historians were describing this room in sort of fanciful terms as magical and mysterious. It's been described as a show place, a giant brain, a place of refuge, a metaphor for the enigma of knowledge and a temple of enlightenment. So I was very curious about that, and as I went on with the research, I realised that I knew that the Dome was a special place, but I hadn't quite appreciated how special and how many various people across Melbourne had written about it and tried to depict it. So some of the themes that I've looked at in this exhibition is the idea of it as an archetypal symbol of, and people think of domes, great domes around the world, whether it's the Pantheon in Rome or St. Peter's or the Hagia Sophia in Istanbul. It's an icon on the skyline, and a lot of people have looked at the way it's remained this timeless icon in the midst of the development around the city and also the library. It symbolises for many people the intellectual heart of the city, the community of scholars that have worked underneath it. The collections are very important. Then we've also got these wonderful interior views, and there's some wonderful descriptions by authors and historians where they've had this eureka moment underneath the dome. And that's made it a very special place for them. The quietness. There's people who've been inspired by the architecture and embellished the architecture. And then the other aspect of the exhibition is that, as Robert mentioned, we've got the program of Creative Fellows, and where we're looking for people who are going to be having thoughtful and creative responses both to our building and the book collections. The other aspect I had in mind was also the physical limitations of the space we were going to have the exhibition in. It's an octagonal room. It's got three massive doorways and bright blue walls. So I decided early on that I was going to, where possible, have very large works on display or group works by the same artist, which immediately meant that I wouldn't be able to display as diverse a range as possible. I started the research in the latter part of 2011, and the way we work at the State Library is my list was delivered to the conservators in the early part of 2012. So I think that was January or February that year. And then I said goodbye to it until we came to present it. So I guess that's a snapshot.
Thanks, Anne. And some issues that we'll probably want to... things you've raised that the artists themselves will want to speak about, but I should introduce each of the artists properly. Julia, in the middle here, is an artist, lecturer, writer, actor and art director, sometimes all at once. You'll see her in the film 67, which follows here after this talk. She wrote and produced this film, and it's a mesmerising and slightly creepy adaptation of one of her paintings, which was set in the reading room. Many books appear in the film as well, as does the State Library Reading Room. And Julia has worked in a library. She worked at the VCA Library when she studied there. And she is now art directing a feature film called Fell, which is about logging. And on Friday, she finds out, because she's on the shortlist for the Archibald Prize, she finds out whether she might win it for her portrait of the book sculptor, Nicholas Jones, who also has a connection with the State Library, and Julia met him here when he was a fellow. Next to me is Ross Coulter, who's an artist who works in film, photography, painting, and a sculptor, and his work often plays with ideas of levity and gravity. Ross once worked intimately, I'd say, in the State Library because he worked 2 days a week in the photocopy department, photocopying. He returned here, not as a photocopier, but in 2010 as a George Mora Fellow in Residence. He has received many awards, which are too numerous to mention. However, the Herald Sun gave him, once described him as, well, the headline said, "Artist Ross Coulter wins $10,000 grant to fly paper planes in State Library." The photograph of 10,000 paper planes flying through the reading room is in the exhibition upstairs, and the film of the event will be shown after we finish having a chat. Some people recall being in the room at the time that the artwork was created and saying it was like being inside a giant snow dome. And I actually think that's something that should be in the library shop. There should be library snow domes. and Marco, in the middle here, at the end there, Marco was born in Benevento, near Naples, in 1969 and came to Australia when he was 4 years old. He is a painter, drawer and printer whose work is in numerous collections around the world, and buildings, cranes and construction appear in many of his drawings, and he is said to be able to talk his way onto any building site. We're just going to sort of free flow here, we're just going to talk generally, and hopefully you'll find some nuggets of what inspired these artists and how they responded. But what do you think generally, what is it, I know Anne touched on this, but what is it about a dome that inspires people? There's something, as I said before, it's a temple, it's an agnostic temple. Why do you think we react the way we do to it?
Well, I think the shape itself is such a contrast to the sort of vertical elements of all other buildings. So when you walk around here at Swanson Street, you know, this sort of the shape of the dome itself is such a contrast from a visual point of view.
Yeah.
I think it's also such a feminine shape against the very masculine vertical elements that are out there in architecture, and particularly in modern architecture with the glass box sort of architecture. I think the dome, it really harks back to, for me, it's like the beginnings of time and civilization and knowledge. So I think the shape itself, for me, it's not a conceptual thing. I see it visually, and I may not be able to even really articulate exactly what I mean by that, but it's sort of an ancient kind of power in the shape of the dome for me.
Do you agree?
I guess thinking about like the inside, for me, it's sort of like a brain or a cranium. And like with the 10,000 paper planes, I was thinking about the way ideas or thoughts might move through space. So when you're sort of seeing people sit at desks, it's these sort of ideas, you can sort of imagine like your thoughts sort of wafting up into the space of the dome. But it's also a place where you can get lost too quite easily. It might sound sort of funny, but yeah, because it sort of all looks the same-ish, except there's a clock. There's a clock that faces west, so if you're like, okay, there's the clock, and you can sort of make out where you are. But it's a space in which you can kind of get lost physically, but also, I think, in your own thoughts as well. To that answer the question?
Yeah, I think so. Yes.
I think for me, I was actually just thinking of the Italian background that we're from too. Is that my dad was a bricklayer, and so he actually used to make, what are they called? They call them...
The ovens.
Well, they're not ovens, they're like the vaulted ceilings.
Oh, yeah.
So
oh,
yeah. Underneath my dad's house in Italy, the whole of the downstairs was a cantina, but it was all vaulted. Yep. So it's quite a... quite an amazing way to build things. And I think when I was about four, I actually went to Dad's hometown, and it probably brings back memories of those vaulted ceilings too. It makes me feel sort of at home. And yeah. Well,
what's, I think, so special also about this particular dome, this reading room, is, you know, when you enter a building with a dome, obviously your eyes go up to the skies. That's where they're led. But here you can go up to the balconies and you can also get that perspective down. So it's a completely different experience because you feel sort of godlike, I suppose. You know, you're up there with the gods in the dome as you look down at people working and like ants. But it's also interesting when you, I think, when you go up, if you go up to, I think it's fourth floor, and you look down. Whenever you see in a public place, when you see a group gathered, it's like a church or a theatre, or like here tonight, everyone is basically assuming the same pose. You know, we're all facing the same direction. But when you get up there and you look down and the people are working at these desks, they're slouching, they're leaning, everyone's doing something sort of different. So it's sort of a chaotic space, which I suppose ties into your idea as well with those flying around, with the planes flying around. And I think if in the show, Oslo Davis, whose work, if you haven't seen it, he's often in the Age, he does those line drawings. His work in this exhibition, I think, captures that slouchy, slovenly use of the reading room. Do you think so, Anne?
Yes. Well, you know, with Ross talking about getting lost in there, and it is, people sit at those desks and they do seem to become totally unaware that there are other people around them. But I was going to ask Julia about those paintings. I was intrigued to see the person looking under the desk because I haven't seen that before. I've seen people sleeping and... but what was that reference that...
I just think I'm pretty curious. So I like to look at all sorts of angles. And I think at the time when we were filming the film, we were filming at sort of 1 a.m. till 5 in the morning. So the security guard kept saying there were ghosts in the building. I don't know if you've heard stories about the ghosts. But I was sort of, you know, there's a lot of time when you're doing film where you're not doing anything, when they're fiddling around with cameras and stuff like that. So... it was also just sort of like, when you actually see the film, it's sort of just part of the mystery of what's going to happen. And so there's not anything that I'm looking at in particular. It's just sort of, you know.
Did the security guard give you any info on the ghosts? Where?
No, but he kept saying that he sees them in a particular spot every time he comes in.
Is he the only security guard who sees the ghosts?
I don't know. He was a bit. He was sort of starting to freak me out a bit. But
right.
Yeah.
What I think also what's special about this, or any dome, but this dome in particular, is the sense of light and that's coming through. But what's interesting, of course, is the dome was copper. It was shuttered for close to 40 years until 1998.
When it reopened in 2003, that was the first time that many people had seen it without the copper sheet.
So several generations of people probably studied there, grew up, and you know, entering there, and it was a place of darkness where those beautiful green lights were what was was creating this sort of intimate effect.
And that's what I remember. I don't remember it being so light and bright.
Yeah,
I remember it being sort of like dark and somewhere where it's almost like womb-like or something.
Yeah,
did so you remember that?
Fine. Same. Yeah.
It's sort of almost. I'm sorry, Anne. It's almost like oppressive, that darkness. Like looking back at some of those early photos, which I think were on a slideshow before we started. But I was thinking about your film as well, Julia. That sort of dark stillness at night, which we don't. That's generally not our experience of the dome now.
No, so. I had quite different memories of it. Like I used to come in from the VCA and walk down and do some studying and researching and sit there, and it was really quite dark. Like, I don't remember the darkness of it all.
And I think that sense of the darkness, and also, as Ross was saying, the fact that it is very hard sometimes to find your way out of the room, that sort of adds a certain sense of claustrophobia. I think that comes through in some of the imagery, that that can be quite claustrophobic, some of the images, or quite dizzying spaces. So in some cases, the art is painted as a sort of a restful environment, and in some other cases, it's quite a restless, as it was with the 10,000 paper planes shooting all around. You know, there's a lot going on in there.
And also because of the architectural shape, the dome, there's also the sense of sound, which is very important. There's no invigilator there anymore to tell people to shush. But do people just respect the space when they're in there, do you think?
Well, that was a very interesting thing when the dome reopened in 2003, because there was a lot of publicity, and maybe some people here came along to the day when the dome reopened, and it was a great celebration. But it also brought in an entirely different audience to work in the dome. And I became aware when I was doing the exhibition too that some of the memories I had of the dome, people working in the dome now don't have any recollection of, or they may not have realised they were sitting in the seat that Alan Sumner wrote Summer of the 17th Doll, or that there was this whole tradition of scholarship and research that had happened in that space. So it's a very different space today. But I think my observation is the exhibition team's offices are off the domed reading room, and the dome changes all the time. But we try and maintain a silent area for people. There are other areas where people can work in groups, and you'll go in there sometimes and it feels like the dome of old, particularly if you come in the evenings. But of course, during the middle of the day, it's filled with light.
That sense of sound must have been interesting, Ross, when you flew your planes. What does it sound like to have 10,000 paper planes shooting through an enclosed space?
It's actually quite violent and crashing. That was quite unexpected to hear, like that sort of, sort of sound.
And that went for...
It's scary.
We'll talk about how you did the work. Yeah. But, I mean, that was like 3 or 4 minutes at a time.
So that was continuous for... There was two sort of events. So, like, continuous for 10 minutes... Yeah. Crashing, and then when the rest of the 10,000 paper planes were released, maybe another five, six minutes.
So the dome acts as a muse, if a building can act as a muse. So can I ask you all, maybe starting with you, Marco, how the library, the exterior in your case, inspired you to for the... It's not a drawing that you did, it's actually a...
A dry point.
A dry point.
Yep.
Yeah.
So for me, first of all, it was as a student in around 1990 at RMIT, and being a sort of eastern suburbs boy, I hadn't really spent a lot of time in the city. The city was the big smoke for me. So coming to study in the city and seeing this beautiful dome was really awe-inspiring for me. And I usually find myself on top of rooftops, so I would go to the top.
Why do you normally find yourself on top of rooftops?
I just walk around and find myself on rooftops. No, I'm interested in the aerial views of cities because it does look different from above. I think you mentioned, just being up in the balcony and the effect of just even being in a balcony looking down. Well, when you're up on buildings and looking down over a city, it's a totally different world. It's quite silent. And so you have a totally different concept of civilization. And so I would set out to find locations, across from RMIT, looking back at the dome. On the RMIT rooftops, I painted images of the dome. So I did a lot of paintings and drawings and etchings that featured the dome because it was such a big presence in the city, and it was really awe-inspiring. So that was the first case that it started to inspire me. And then also in 2003, when they refurbished the dome, I spent a lot of time at the QVB site. I was inducted onto the site and spent a lot of time up there with my copper. And you mentioned earlier that the dome just appears... such a big sort of presence in all over the world with Florence and those sort of places. Well, for me, it looked like the sort of the top of a whale. So it actually kind of looked like an ancient creature rising from the city. So for me, it was kind of this amazing, crazy juxtaposition of the cranes at the QVB site, which were making these huge screeching noises against this silent, beautiful creature that just looked like it was bobbing every now and then above the city. So that's what I really wanted to kind of capture. And yeah, I spent a lot of time scratching directly onto a plate, a copper sheet, and scraping the copper sheet on the rooftop to try to get to sort of imbue some of the rooftop's energy and surfaces onto the plate, and then scratching and gouging directly onto the plate, sometimes so deep that it would carve my hand up, and it'd be very exciting up there. It was
How long were you up there for?
18 months. So, you know, I sort of captured the dome as the workers were putting in the windows. And, you know, the other image called Escalator, which features an escalator leading to nowhere, that the dome features in the background as a kind of reminder of what beautiful architecture is. And the escalator leading to nowhere, I think, is more interesting than what it is now, actually, which is a shopping centre. And so I found that was a really nice juxtaposition for me as well. Right. So there was lots of opportunity using the dome as a muse for me. Yeah. And it still is. It still pops up in my work. Yeah.
Julia, do you remember the first time you ever entered the reading room?
Yeah, I was studying up the road at VCA, and I was doing some research, because those days we didn't have the internet, so we'd have to, if there was a particular artist or a contemporary person that you wanted to look up, you'd have to go to the library and look it up. So I would come down to the library and start researching books. And
so you've grown up that when you went in there for the first time, you'd have
entered the building. I didn't come as a child. Yeah. So I probably would have been sort of 17 or 18 when I first. Although I studied RMIT, so I'd come in.
Right. So what was your reaction? Did you think I didn't know Melbourne had this incredible architectural space?
Well, I kept thinking of the darkness and the green lights and stuff like that. So, but I actually didn't find it depressing. I found it quite a great space, because you came from all this hustle and bustle outside, and then you'd come into this great, quiet, dark space. So I really enjoyed coming in here and researching, because you just could just be, right, you could just become, you know, part of yourself rather than thinking of all the other stuff around you.
Did you all come from, I mean, bookish families? No.
No, not for me.
No.
You did. Yeah, like a book club. Because in the exhibition, there's a Daddy, we can Daddy, I Hardly Knew You, the Germaine Greer book. It's open on a page where she describes the reading room, and she talks about having grown up in a bookless prison, and how coming to the library was this incredible act of emancipation and wonder. So it's interesting. We were talking before about visual artists responding to a place of books and how you interpret that space. And Ross, though, for you, I gather your inspiration for this work, of the work you've done, is from that time where you worked at the library in the photocopy department. Now, I suppose, do they still have photocopy departments? They do,
but no, I think they're unpersoned.
Okay. All right.
There's just the machines have taken
just
over.
Just hell. Okay.
I think.
So you would come in, you'd clock on for what, 8 hours?
Yeah, I think we did like, there's like 4 and 8 hour shifts, but usually it's just like a 4 hour and then a 4 hour shift.
And
yeah.
What were you doing? Were you photocopying for students, for people? Or?
Just helping people to photocopy, to explain how the Konicas work. And
right.
You need to put money onto a card, and you can use any card.
But did you like actually have to stand there, you know?
Not often, no. I'd assist people do that, though.
Right, yeah. Yes. No. So the first time you flew a paper plane...
Oh, yes, yeah. Oh, that's right.
In the library?
Yeah. I was sort of wondering, because people get quite obsessed about photocopying and getting, like, a perfect copy, and you can only copy 10% of a publication or one chapter. So people discard photocopies that weren't up to scratch. And I was sort of, but some people would try to photocopy like an entire book, and I was sort of wondering about this knowledge. Like, even if you had this photocopy of this book and you put it on the bookcase, would you have like the knowledge? And I came across this word called nympholepsy, which is this love or attraction of the unobtainable. And I sort of felt that this photocopying was this kind of like this nympholeptic act because you could never sort of get it and like get this perfect copy.
Yeah.
Anyway, one morning tea break, I went to the recycle bin and took out a piece of paper and folded it up. And on my tea break, I went to the... Because the dome was being renovated at that time, so I went up to the fourth floor and released a paper plane.
And did you feel as if you were being doing something slightly wrong or criminal?
I sort of did. I thought, like, oh, it's a bit illicit, you know? Like, this is pretty exciting.
And it was just an empty space when you threw it?
Yeah, but the disappointing thing was the plane just went... It dived.
Right.
So, sort of thinking back now, I was like, oh, no, it just went down. And I sort of wonder if, like, this project is the fulfillment of, like, the plane having lift and life or something.
Were you a good paper plane maker beforehand? I mean, had you always had a...
No, not at all. And it was, like, a couple of years later that I thought about doing with 1,000 paper planes and then 10,000.
Had you seen anyone else, you know, this act of insurrection throwing paper planes in the dome, in the library?
No, but I've spotted some planes, that other people had thrown. There's one in the chess centre where the chess collection is. You can look across towards the dome and there's, on a grey ledge, there's this wide-wing kind of glider. And there's a few others around the place.
I wonder if you... Can you get addicted to photocopying, do you think?
I think some people... Like, it gave some people... That's a great thing about the library is having... You know, it's a place that people can access. It's a public space. You don't need to pay to come in unless you're putting your bag away.
So were you like an invigilator yourself? I mean, if people were photocopying too much, you know...
We'd have to, like, enforce.
Just a stop. You know, you're going too far there, but...
You sort of turn a blind eye a little bit.
Right. And Julia, as you'll see in Julia's work when you go upstairs and you'll see in the film, books appear, you know, they're very present in your work. They're about books. And you'll see in the film someone lugging out of the sea this pile of books. So what are you saying about the act of reading? I mean, it's sort of a
question. I think, I'm not going to tell you what I was sort of trying to say because I'd like you to interpret that at the end of the movie. But all through my life, even though I wasn't in a book sort of family because both my parents were from working class backgrounds.
And Julia, your family are from 100 kilometres from where you're from?
20, 30 minutes,
In Italy, in
20,
Naples.
30 minutes.
The same town. Yeah. And I... really loved books and the idea of just opening up a book and then an image coming at you and then you could interpret it the way you wanted to interpret it and then from that image or from that basis of writing you could then make up a whole new story or that could inspire you to create your own work. So I did do a series of works on some books that were written in 1663 called Fictitious Voyages, and there were only I think there was only one known copy of this particular book that was written in English. The others were all written in Old French, and I think the one copy that I could find was at the State Library, so I had to get it photocopied. But it was that was another really sort of poignant time in you know, like my history through.
And so if you maybe can explain that connection because of the Archibald, the subject, Nicholas Jones, who's a book sculptor.
Yes.
If you could, and whose portrait you've just painted.
Yep.
He is a fellow here this year.
Yep.
He's in the audience.
He's in the audience.
All right. So can you explain how visual artists got together through books?
Okay. So we both were up on this stage, I don't know how many years ago. Now, but Nick had this fantastic moustache, like this great big sort of Salvador Dali moustache, and I just kept looking at him going, good moustache. And my kids were studying Salvador Dali at the time, and I thought he'd be great to open up this art show at the primary school, and we became friends through that. And through that, I just, you know, he's just got a great face, and he does these magnificent sculptures out of books. So I had this vision of Nick standing in front of one of his sculptures, and I just went ahead and painted. I didn't particularly paint it for the Archibald. In fact, I just painted him because I thought he was a great-looking person. And it just happened to get, chosen for the Archibald. So.
Both of you, your families are from the same area in Italy and you've got the same background. Do you think there's something about that Italian background that makes you respond to this sort of dome building, domed building, given Rome or Naples?
I didn't used to think so, but I think, our bodies are imbued with things from the past that we don't necessarily, that we're not really conscious of, but I think it comes through. So, I mean, my dad was also a bricklayer, and so I think there's probably an interest there that you don't necessarily, you can't really see it at the forefront when you're making these images, but I think all that stuff does come through. And, for me, it was always flicking through photo albums of, architecture from Italy and looking at films and things like that. So that stuff, I think now I see that, it does come through. You don't have to make a conscious effort to access that. Yeah. But we've got that in us. That past is in us.
Well, you're drawn to cities. I'm painting the frenetic activity of cities. And, and you've been in... you did an exhibition in Florence.
I made work in Florence.
Yeah. And
of the Duomo. So for me, the lovely thing that what I really like about buildings is when they're being either pulled down or when they're being built. So when I did the State Library, it was during that process where they had scaffolding around the dome. And then the same thing in Italy. There's always scaffolding around the Duomo in Italy. Yeah. And it is interesting what people do say about domes. I showed both domes in New York in an exhibition 2 years ago at the Australian Consulate, and the comments about the dome from one particular fella were really fascinating, and he just felt that the dome was a completely something... I think he was a bit odd, actually, but he thought it was a very sexual beast. And he was talking to me in a way that we didn't spend a lot of time with him after that.
So, I mean... Well, you've talked about the dome as a whale, a humpback whale, or whatever.
Yeah, that's right.
You've also talked about it. It's feminine.
It is feminine.
Given the rest of the city is vertical or phallic.
That's
whatever.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I think buildings have a certain character and personality. In fact, one gentleman I was speaking to recently was, he's writing a book about, some buildings are Italian buildings and Italian people, and they have Italian personalities, and some people. So he's looking at it that way. And I think buildings have character, and they have there is something very human when they're built beautifully like the dome is, and I think that's why it's so timeless. They do have it. I think the humanity is what makes the dome here so beautiful. There's a at 3 or 4 in the afternoon on an autumn day, I remember walking down Swanson Street and the light would hit the whole of the dome and the side of the building, and it would be absolutely inspiring. It would make me want to, make more work and even write, and I'm not much of a writer. It would make me want to, do things that a beautiful building, can inspire. I think the dome here could be a great emphasis for improving the whole of Swanson Street, because I think Swanson Street could be a marvellous street. It could be absolutely stunning.
What do you mean, more domes?
More domes? No, not necessarily, but I think we should look at the fact that it's bookended. You've got the dome here, and then you've got the kind of dome at, Flinders Street Station. Yep. And then you've got another green dome. You might know it, Anne. You know the one at South Bank, the little green dome. Does anyone know the dome at South Bank when you look back at the city? So there are a few domes from one end to the other. And, the history that's on Swanson Street. So one of the things I did here as a student, but also returning all the time to, is Swanson Street. I've been documenting it. I think it could be an amazing street starting here and going down to Flinders Street.
Do you think the dome... I mean, I don't think the dome is celebrated enough in Melbourne iconography. I don't think we talk about it. It's not really... people talk about the 12 apostles and this and that, but we don't... I don't think we appreciate it enough. Sorry?
I think it's a logo almost. I made some images, little etchings, where it was just the outline, and trying to understand what is it about the shape, the silhouette of it. I think it's almost a logo. It could actually be turned. The library itself could become a logo,
Even though everyone who knows the library, I mean, it is absolutely part of Melbourne, but there's some of the works in this exhibition, and I think it doesn't look like Melbourne. In Rick Amor's painting of the dome, it's from the rooftop looking at the dome. It feels, I don't know, it feels like a sort of a... Another city, another mysterious city, which I find with a lot of Rick's works, even though you know they're in Frankston or whatever. He creates this otherworldly aspect to it.
I think his work is so enigmatic, and I love looking at that painting. And when I first looked at it, I thought, oh, is this the ruins of civilization? You know, got this sort of buildings falling down. The pediment is from Spencer Street. What I thought was sort of classical ruins, air conditioning, ducts on roofs. But he's an artist who came here. He studied under John Brack. He came here and researched in the Dome, wandered through the Dome on his way to the art school when it was on this site. And his family have a tradition of working in the Dome. So he's got this great love of the Dome and sees it as a place where he got a lot of support and nurturing for his own art by looking through art journals. So I think that painting, for me, is the Dome is a beacon, yeah. But it is imbued with that sort of European sensibility.
Yeah, and there's also that sense of melancholy because of the colours he uses, the sepia colours and those greens and those sort of deep sort of hues.
And sunset.
And in fact, there's a work in the exhibition by an employee of the library.
Fiona Jeffrey's beautiful painting, which is hanging near Rick and Moore's, and that is, again, that whole wall, they're contemporary paintings, but there's a lot of history in them. There's a lot of interest in history. She's looked at a photograph from the Argus newspaper and has been interested in that period of the library in the 1930s when it was really more dominating on the skyline. And then, of course, Louise Fawthon's work, then and now, also looking at the changes in the cityscape.
Well, Louisa, I see, is in the audience tonight, but her work, that sort of X-ray sort of feeling, to me, if when you go upstairs and have a look, I think the Dome looks like a flying saucer that has just landed in the middle of Melbourne, which reminds me again of the 1950s film we were talking about, On the Beach. Mm. There's something sort of, you know, Space Invaders, Invasion of the Body Snatchers or something element to it. Maybe we could just talk about the individual works, because it's often interesting to hear about how you actually construct the work you do, what the physical nature of it. And Ross, if you could maybe put, you know, you're seeing this image up here, but obviously doing something like that is enormously complicated.
Yeah, but it was funny, the first day, well, after I received the fellowship and Gail Schmidt took me through the space of the Dome reading room, I felt quite overwhelming. Like, it was quite, wow, how is this going to sort of happen? And I think it just, like one paper plane at a time. It's just, I think it just unfolded very slowly. And we're with a lot of support from the library and our friends and volunteers, whether it's part of the crew or...
You have the Australian paper plane champion working with you.
Yeah, James Norton from he's based in Canberra. He came down a couple of times and consulted, and we did tests after hours in the Dome reading room, which is amazing, as Julia may talk about as well, being in this space after hours when there's no one else around. You can sort of...
But did you all have to do the same paper plane for maximum aerodynamics?
Yeah, so there was 35 people that folded planes, and there are some amazing plane folders here. I can see them in the audience. So it took 35 people, 5 weeks. We folded them all beforehand and then stored them. Then distributed them the night before, had the choreography, and James Norton was... He actually tested every paper plane he threw.
Hang on, 10,000?
Yeah, because they can't... You have to store them very carefully. If they bend a little bit, they need to be trimmed.
Yeah.
And with Jenny Turnbull, my mother-in-law, James, and he'd actually dislocated his shoulder. He was just throwing them, but he still wanted to be a part of the... He was throwing them to Jenny, and then Jenny was putting them back into the boxes. And so each plane was trimmed.
I was going to ask, when you've got 10,000 paper planes flying around, were there any injuries?
Yeah, just one.
Oh, who?
One hit me in the eye.
Oh, you? You should aviator glasses or whatever. And I understand you had people called wing commanders.
Yeah, so there was 165 people involved in the launch, and 35 of those were wing commanders, and Robert Heather here, who was a wing commander, and would have a headset on, and I would say, you know, cue. Oh, there's more paper playing. I can see some more. Yeah. What's the question? Julia, the wing commanders. Oh, wing commanders will get the cue to go. Yes, go. You know, I had the choreography and say, blue two, go. Blue three, go. Blue four, go.
Did you ever think of having coloured paper planes?
Yep.
And why did you reject that?
Just because, like, a blank piece of paper has all the potential, and, yeah, colours would have just, you know, made it more theatrical. And I think in keeping with the space as well.
So they're absolutely white. Pure white, no writing?
No writing, because you have to have like a brand new piece of A3 paper because you can't have any creases when you fold it. It has to be perfect.
Yeah. And Julia, you were here overnight too, filming. What was that experience like? The ghosts you mentioned, but...
It was quite beautiful, actually, because it's you're walking in sort of drizzling with rain outside and coming in when you know that you're not supposed to be in here, but you're allowed to be in here. And it's 1 o'clock in the morning and you're sort of going, I should be asleep, but I'm in this room. And the sound is quite beautiful too, because you can hear sort of every footstep you take. So you can hear this duk, duk. And so everybody that was filming had to be really, really quiet, because you could pick up every sort of little sound that was sort of happening. So it was quite a beautiful feeling. And... yeah, just really peaceful. I found it very peaceful, actually.
So. You said that when you first approached the library to film, you had to go through the commercial arm.
Oh, yes.
And that was going to cost $10,000
a night? Yeah, I think they heard film and they went, oh, film. And, okay, that's going to cost you $10,000 for the hire of the space. And I said, I don't have $10,000. We'll get back to you. So that $10,000 was then cut. And then... Then they said that I had to spend another $10,000 on liability insurance, and I said, I'm going to throw myself in the ocean. I have no liability insurance. So they cut the other $10,000, and then they said, you do need to have some security guards, and I had to get a security guard, which I think that cost me $1,000 for the security guard. So overall, I did quite well, I think.
Right. Yeah. And Marco, when people see, if they haven't seen your dry point, it looks like there is a giant wrecking ball.
Yeah, it started off as a vessel for carrying concrete. So one of those, I find them really fascinating in themselves as they're floating above the city. You know, they're so heavy you wouldn't want them to drop, but they look quite mysterious when they're moving around on their own. And then just in the right spot where the crane would stop with the carrying this mixed concrete thing, which was about to land, as I was scraping away, it started to become a beautiful rounded shape. And I kind of got a sense that it might look a little bit more ambiguous as something that could possibly be seen as more than just a vessel carrying something, but maybe it could be seen as something that, could possibly be knocking down the dome. But I didn't set out to do that, but I discovered as I was doing it, it kind of became that. And then I pursued that further and encouraged it more and more. So you get this idea that maybe it's, a comment on tearing down buildings, or maybe it's not that at all. But that makes it ambiguous and makes it a little bit more interesting, I guess.
I mean, the fascination you have with construction, is that all due to your father, the bricklayer?
Yeah, he was a really bad builder. Like... he was awful. Like maybe it was just my mum giving him a hard time, but all I heard was how bad he was. But his car was always filled with bricks and tools and buckets and things like that. And the backyard was always filled with messy concrete things. And I always loved the way that he'd mix the concrete. And even if his things that he was building were a bit wobbly, he built a lot of buildings in Italy. He built houses for people, and apparently
they're still standing.
Sorry?
Are they still standing?
Apparently so. And he's helped here in Australia. He built a lot of illegal cellars for Italians around around Australia. And this, other than being maybe flooded three quarters of the way up, which ours was often, they're actually pretty good. But so I was kind of... I was always interested in the idea of, man building things. I'm really bad at building.
Did you ever do any construction work yourself?
I'm really hopeless. Deborah, who's sitting there, is just building some shelves today for our studio, and she does all that handiwork. She's got a doorknob to fix as well. But I'm really... but people assume that I because I'm interested in these things, and I get inducted on site. And sometimes when I've got my red jacket, you know, I've got my red card, I've got my red jacket on and a yellow hat, my whatever coloured hat, and people just assume I must be able to build things, I must be able to do stuff. But I'm really, really quite... I built a 1.5 metre pathway once, and I invited people to come and have a look. And people laughed because it was only 1.5 metres, and that was my biggest building achievement. So,
But there's also that when you see your dry points as well, it's sort of like there's this children's illustration aspect to it. You know, the diggers and the construction.
Yeah,
and you mentioned before you're working on a kid's book.
I'm working on, well, it's kind of a kid's book. It's about Australian animals that become human. It's written by John Hughes, who also wrote The Remnants. And it's 80 etchings about Australian animals that become human, but they absolutely massacre each other. And so it's not really a kid's book. People ask me, is it a kid's book? I mean, it's probably something that you'd read with your kid, but sort of more like Grimm Tales.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We haven't got much more time, but I just thought we should ask a question. Do you think... If we were building a public building, like a major public building like the State Library today, would we put a dome on it? Or a dome seen as old-fashioned? Because I was just trying to think of what domes have been built recently, and we were talking before maybe the Millennium Dome, I think, in London. And I think there was some criticism of that dome because it was seen as, you know, a retro, you know, it wasn't forward-looking. Do you think we've got a... We don't celebrate domes enough? It's a shape.
I think the shape, as you and I talked about today, the shape's repeated in things like the soccer stadium. It's repeated without being obvious. So I think that lovely circular... I mean, Southern Cross Station, I spent 18 months on there, and the beautiful flow, especially from up high. So I think the elements of dome building... I don't think we necessarily need to build more domes. It's good to build things that are of our time.
I actually think, was it in the 90s that Jeff Kennett, I think, suggested that the dome... There was originally supposed to be a dome on the Parliament House, and he initiated trying to get the dome built, and it all fell apart. I don't know why. Did you know anything about that dome, Anne?
I remember that because I think also the original designs for the Parliament House, there was a dome. And similarly, the first designs for this building, there was a dome, but not the dome as we know it today. Yeah, I have this... I like the symbolism of the dome. I don't know whether we need to build more domes. I always look across at RMIT and the green brain on the building at RMIT, and I wonder whether Ashton Raggett and McDougall have invented the new dome with the green brain.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I don't think we need more domes, but we certainly need... more interesting architecture across the city.
Yeah,
maybe more spaces that are free for the public to use, if anything else, that you can get shelter or commune with people.
Yeah.
Also that Siemens mission, have you ever been into there? That's pretty amazing.
Have you been in that dome? Or?
Yeah, I have,
That's a good one. Yeah. And also Flinders Street, as you mentioned as well. Yeah.
And that, I don't know if people saw Flinders Street on... the White Night Festival, but that was fantastic, that dome lit up with purple and green and as a stage. And as you were saying, Ray, I don't think we celebrate some of the things we've got already enough.
Yeah.
And certainly that was a great night for the Flinders Street dome. And it was a great night in here too for our dome interior. I think I'm with Ross, though, that it's this whole idea of having places that are refuges for people and community spaces that... anyone can come into and feel comfortable and work and, just that wonderful free access.
It's maybe time for the films, but just one final question. Would you use the dome again in an artwork? I mean, would you interpret it again or do you think this was your...
I don't know, Not this week. Yeah, not in the short term,
And Julia?
I don't know about the dome.
I mean the room, yeah.
Yeah, but I'm sure that I'd probably want to do some more work with books and I wanted to get into the area where you weren't supposed to get into, so I'll be working on that one, I think, soon.
And Marco, your inspiration for domes is endless, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I think it'll always pop up, in especially in the aerial views, but I'm also working on a comic book that has the dome, post-apocalyptic kind of...
this one?
Yeah.
Yeah. So. All right. Oh, well, thank you very much, everyone. I think we're going to have the two films now, beginning with Julia's 67.